Nope. Seen it. Oh, nah.
Can't find something to watch? Introducing Sky Stream. It's Sky without the dish. Watch unmissable Sky exclusives like The Regime and Netflix too, all over super reliable Sky full fibre broadband. Get Sky Stream, Sky Broadband and Netflix for just €50 a month. Search Sky Stream. Availability subject location. New customers only. 12-month minimum term. Stream and broadband sold separately. Further terms apply. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds.
On this week's Big Tech Show, how will the latest developments in artificial intelligence affect your life? Will you get new powerful personal assistants? Are you in danger of something terrible happening? We explain what's going on.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Anthropic, which is OpenAI competitor, their startup lab, actually founded by former OpenAI employees, they actually eclipsed GPT-4 only just a couple of weeks ago with their latest model, and the internet went crazy. This is just better than GPT-4 at everything. So OpenAI had to respond to that.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
Listeners should be aware this podcast contains strong language. Today on the Indo Daily, a story of drugs, crime and redemption.
They'd obviously gained entry and they'd seen a letter with my name on it and my phone number, and they'd rang my phone. And if anybody in the room had seen me that day, they would have seen the blood drain from my face. I picked up the phone, they said, look, it's Blanchardstown, I think this guard station here, and we've raided our property and we found something that you might want to come back here. And I was like, I was forced driving to the estate. There was like 6 or 7 squad cars, and then I remember walking to the apartment and there was like 12 guards just standing around sitting there. And you know, I was hoping that they found maybe a robbed laptop or something, but it wasn't. It was all the drugs. You found 59 quarters of crack cocaine bagged up and sealed in a safe, and an ounce of heroin as well.
For years, Daniel Moore felt he didn't fit in anywhere before realising that only he could turn his life around.
Walking up to the door of Kilmoyne Lodge, I was shaking. Pure fear, fear of the unknown, fear of everything. What am I doing here? It was actually scarier going into treatment than it was going into prison.
I'm Kevin Doyle, and today on the Indo Daily, we hear a story of life inside prison and what happens afterwards. Daniel, you've come in today to tell a story that involves an upbringing in foster care, drug addiction, time in prison, and I might as well give away the ending, a better ending, a happier ending. Why do you want to talk about all of this?
Well, I suppose the real reason I'd like to talk about it is to raise awareness that there is help out there, and that anybody that is struggling, that doesn't have to be a life.
Well, let's go back to your youth,
yeah,
in some ways, because you started getting involved with a bit of alcohol, a bit of drugs, messing with the wrong people at a very young age. But you say you didn't have a bad upbringing, even though you didn't know your parents.
No, so I wouldn't have had any relationship with my actual biological parents. I never knew who my father was. My mother, the relationship put me there. I had a great upbringing when it comes to my foster parents who looked after me. They were actually my auntie and uncle, believe it or not. But yeah, I had a great upbringing, but I think there was just something that just didn't feel right, and I sort of went with that, you know. I felt a little bit left out, yeah, I did. Did I think I was the sort of black sheep of the family? Maybe these things crossed my mind. And did I use them as excuses? I would have, yeah. So as time went on, I seeked acceptance. Obviously, not feeling too accepted in a family home, which, look, I was accepted, but me personally, I wasn't accepted enough. That's obviously how I felt. So I seeked acceptance, and what I done was everything to try and be accepted.
And as part of that, you started doing drugs.
Yeah, so I would have started doing drugs at a young age, and drinking alcohol. Well,
what's
at a young
the young age now? 13, 14?
Yeah, like 13, 14. I think I would have been 12 or 13 when I first tried smoking hash.
How does a 12-year-old even get hash?
So it was actually, we were in a friend's house, and he was like, look, I found this in my brother's pocket. And I was like, I don't know if anybody listened, they'd probably know it was like a quarter of hash, just a little block. And we barely didn't know what to do with it, but we attempted to smoke it, and me being me, I went out and the girl who I'm with now, seeing her and me wanting to show off, I was like, oh, look what we have, you know? And she was like, I'm telling.
So she actually told, and I remember I got grounded for like 3 months or something like that. But still to this day, I hold it. I was, maybe you rat on me. She's like, I didn't. I was just looking out for you. But we started, yeah. So like at that age, I was intrigued to know what it was about. And then from then, I started obviously drinking alcohol. I was just curious, I guess. I then got a job in the local pub. And if anybody knows the Cardiff Inn, it's a great ale boozer, but it's a bit of a mad shop, you know. Back then it wasn't anyway. There would have been people killed in that pub. There would have been a lot of criminality in the area. But I was attracted to all this at that age. So I started drinking, started going back to parties after the pub. Now, I would have been the youngest person there. And I remember it was back at a party where I tried my first line of cocaine. And I probably in around 15, 16 maybe I was. And I was quite young, but I loved what it gave me when I tried it, you know. The acceptance that I was looking for, that's what I got.
So you were trying to be part of the gang or part of the pack?
Yeah, like part of the pack. I just want to fit in here. And somebody had said to me, oh, look, do you want a bit of coke? And I was like, yeah, of course. I didn't play it down. I didn't act as if I was sure. I was like, yeah, and I just done it. What did I feel? It was like just pure acceptance and felt a part of, I guess.
And how did you go then from drug user to, well, would you have described yourself as a drug dealer?
No, so obviously as my childhood went on, I would always work, just getting up to the usual young adult things like drinking, doing a bit of drugs on the weekend, socially, I suppose. And I always looked at it that way. I always looked at it socially. It was when I sort of lost my job is where I needed to make money. And that's when I said, look, drugs is a quick and easy fix. Everybody knows you can make quick money off drugs. So that's what I needed to do.
So at this stage, you were around 20 and you'd been working as a fitter.
Yeah, so I worked as a cabinet maker at this point. So I'd left the pub, myself and my partner were having our first child. So we were quite ecstatic about it. And I always wanted to be the one who provides. But obviously when I was told I'm going to lose my job, it was, what do I do here? So I needed to make money. And drugs was the only thing to make money in my area then, you know. Well, that's what I thought. So I got down the road of selling drugs, started selling crack cocaine and heroin. And yeah, I thought it was nothing like me. The money was there. Life was great. I thought it was this big hotshot. And it all went tits up then, and the guards rang. Said they were letting me, they've had the gain and access into my apartment, and they found everything.
Yeah, tell me this story because I don't want to make light of it, but it is a little bit Fawlty Towers. The guards raided your house and then rang you to tell you they were in your house.
Yeah, so it was on the weekend. I think I was over my mother's. They'd obviously gained entry and they'd seen a letter with my name on it and my phone number, and they'd rang my phone. And if anybody in the room had seen me that day, they would have seen the blood drain from my face. I picked up the phone. They said, look, it's Blanchardstown and Finglas Garda Station here, and we've raided your property and we found something that you might want to come back here. And I was like, uh-oh. You know, I was hoping that they found maybe a robbed laptop or something, but it wasn't. It was all the drugs. I was forced driving at the estate. There was like 6 or 7 squad cars. And then I remember walking into the apartment and there was like 12 guards just standing there and sitting there. And my first initial thing was like, look, I said to the guards, my partner doesn't know anything about this. I said, I don't want her to be involved in this anyway. Look, it's nothing to do with her. And fair play to them. They said, yeah, look, down to the back room. And they brought me down to the back bedroom. And they said, look, here we go. There it is. And I was like, yeah, it is. And they're like, we weren't expecting this. That's
what they said. What have they found?
So they found 59 quarters of crack cocaine bagged up and sealed in a safe and an ounce of heroin as well. A substantial amount of drugs. Like they said it themselves, they had a warrant for weed. You know what I mean? And that's all they thought.
What attracted the guards to you? Why were they coming to your house? You must have been, you were 18 months dealing at this stage.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a backstory to that. I would never have done that around my area. I've always done stuff elsewhere around Blanchardstown because I didn't want anybody, because crack at the time, it was a bad thing to sell. And so was heroin, you know. If you're selling cocaine, I know the two of them are completely the same. It's just how they're administered. But if you're selling weed or cocaine, like a social drug, would you say, it's almost like, oh, he's a good guy. But if you're selling crack and heroin, it's like, he's a dope lord. So I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing. So in my eyes, I was baffled as to how they gained entry and got this information. Now, look, the guard said it. We were tipped off. And I was like, okay, but they were tipped off that I was selling weed. So they showed me the warrant for weed and they were like, we weren't expecting this. And we giggled and I said, well, I wasn't expecting you either, you know, that way. Like, but so yeah, that's what led me to getting 4 years in prison then. And that's another chapter then, which was absolutely crazy.
Well, what did your partner say when the guards, like, you couldn't have hidden this from her because you had to go to court?
Yeah, so it was actually, so I obviously had to complain to my partner at some point. But I remember when we were walking out of the apartment with the guards had everything in a big, like, evidence bag, and they had told my partner, said, look, it's only stolen goods. Like, they were obviously trying to keep her as well away from us. So fair play to them in that sense. But look, I had to complain, I had to tell my partner what I'd done. She was shocked, obviously. But look, she was supportive. She always is supportive. But she was obviously scared as well.
And were you a dad at this point?
I was, yeah. So I would have had my first child at this point. So I had all this to think about as well, you know. I was looking at a heavy prison sentence at this point. Like, the charge I had was a 15A charge, and I carried a mandatory 10 years. So in my eyes, I was like, this is crazy, you know.
The judge let you off with 4.
Let me off, yeah, it's a way of putting it. Very lenient, yeah. So, like, I remember standing in front of the judge. I didn't waste anybody's time. Like, I wanted to get it over and done with as soon as possible. Obviously, the reason, because I had my child. A lot of people, when they come across these types of charges, they drag it out for years. I didn't want that. I just wanted to get it over and done with. Get in and get out, you know. If it was 10 years, I wanted to start it now. So the judge said to me, look, obviously, you didn't waste anybody's time. This carries a 10-year sentence, but he said, I'm not going to do that. He says, I'll give you 4 years. So as much as a relief, it was still very, very scary to know that I'm actually going to be in prison here for 4 years. And it was only when I got in, somebody had said to me, for every prison year, it's 9 months. Like, you get 3 months remission. So I was thinking, okay, 3 years. But still very, very, very crazy to think that I was going to be in a prison cell for 3 years.
Do you remember the first day going into Mountjoy?
Yeah, it was absolutely nothing like I thought. It was like out of a movie. It was just real doom and gloom. You know that way? It was almost like, what is going on here? The walls, the painting on the walls, all just grey and just dull and old machinery. And I'm just like, what the hell? Like, they had this one machine, they call it the boss. You know, you have to sit on it to check and make sure you have nothing inside you or anything like that. And I was sitting on it, like, starkers in front of these men and they're asking to squat. It was all really crazy. And then I remember I got put into a cell and I was in the cell on my own. There was no telly, no nothing. And I was just like, how am I after getting myself into this situation? Like, what has happened? At one point, I sort of laughed to myself out of pure nerves and not knowing what to do. But I just, it was then I had to just come to terms with what was happening. Like, I really had to just come to terms.
And what, so you had gone from a world with your child, your partner, your foster family, and now describe the world now. The wall's almost closed in on you in this cell.
The wall is closed in on my cell. I'm the only person there alone with my thoughts. If there was a telly, it might have helped, but there wasn't even a telly there to try and take my mind off things. So I was just there with my mind, with my thoughts. And when you're in the mix of drugs and everything, you never ever think that you're going to get caught. I never thought I was going to get caught. And I was in Mountjoy and I was looking to be there for 3 years, you know.
And how does that, I mean, we've all seen the movie, you said it was like a movie. We've all seen the movies where you have to find your pack, you have to make friends, you have to, you know, watch your back, all of that. Like, what is the lifestyle like in terms of that? Or what are the, did you know people in there already? Was it intimidating?
So, look, I could have went in there, I always say this, I could have went in there with a chip on my shoulder, acted a hard man. It wouldn't have stood to me, it would have just made things harder. I went in there as just a scared person. But at the end of the day, I knew not to show too much vulnerability, because obviously that would have been seeked out by certain people. So I went in there and I was just being myself. I did come up onto the land, and I remember walking up onto D1, and I did know one or two people. They came over to me, they greeted me and they gave me clothes and stuff, which was almost like a little bit welcoming, but still at the end of the day, it was just all crazy. I've seen a lot of crazy characters in there. A lot of crazy things are seen in there, some serious beatings, and as you get talking to people, you hear what they're in for, which is like, whoa, you know that way. Like, I remember, I think it was 2 weeks in, and a guy next to me, real nice chap, obviously me coming from where I came from, I wouldn't have taught anybody else, it's just I don't know, it was weird. I didn't have any judgment on anybody. And he was like, "Oh, how's things?" And I was chatting away. And he's like, "So, what are you in for?" And I was like, "Oh, 15A. And I was like, "Okay, so he's asked me, I'll ask him." And I was like, "What are you in for?" He's like, "Oh, murder." And I was like, "Oh, shit." Like, you know, it was like, real, oh, what do I do here? Like, do I continue talking or do I just lead in this awkward silence? Yeah. I was like, this awkward silence. And I was like, "Oh, right, yeah, you know." Playing as if I knew all about it, but it was weird, and that's what I was thinking. Jeez, like,
and was that like a gangland murder or
no? No, no, it was actually, it was just a murder. He'd actually killed his parents. He'd actually killed his parents. I didn't ask him that. He just said murder, and I left it at that. I didn't want to get into detail. It was actually somebody else was talking to, who was in with a similar charge to me, and I said, "Look, that dude's had to tell me." He's like, "Yeah, yeah, he killed his parents," and I'm like, "Oh man," but. He was a sound fella, you know. He was a down and he's a good guy, like, you know. And I didn't judge him for what he'd done. It was
the rules are different when you're all in that cage,
absolutely,
than that what they would be out in the rest of the world.
Yeah, like if I'm people out here now hear these things and people commit crimes, they just see them for the crime they commit.
Well, I find it hard to compute that you just said someone who killed his parents is a sound fella.
Yeah, but like that, he was a really, really good guy. So yeah, people would find it hard to believe. He made a mistake, whatever brought him to that mistake, he done it. But deep down, he was actually a nice guy.
Were you doing drugs when you were in prison?
It wasn't so much. There's a lot of heroin in jail. There is a lot of drugs in the jail. I actually found my love of coffee in the jail. I used to hate coffee, hate it with a passion. And it was when I was in there, I said, right, in a cell, pure boredom sets in, you know. And I'm like, I need to do something. I'm like, do I start smoking? And I was like, no, I don't like smokes. Never liked smokes. I was like, drinking, look, there's hooch there. I'll definitely have a dabble in hooch, you know, and white lightning and all that. I was like, do I go to drugs? I was like, I don't want to do drugs here, you know. I don't want to get down that road of... So I said, coffee, I wonder what coffee's like, you know. So I started making that little sachet.
There are definitely worse things to be addicted to.
Yeah, so I got a... It was almost like my mind said, right, it has to be coffee because if it's going to be anything else, you're screwed. So I remember making the coffee, put an extra bit of sugar in it, made it with a load of milk. And I remember took a sip and I was like, okay, look, this is what's going to have to be. So like that, I just started drinking coffee all the time. And that was like my little thing.
So you did your 3+ years.
Yeah.
You kept the head down, stayed out of trouble. Mm. Do you remember the day walking out as well as you do the day walking in?
Yeah, I remember walking out and having all these promises and all these things that I'm going to do and the job I'm going to get and how I'm going to be so supportive and I'm never going to go back to that life. And I fell flat on my face after about 3 weeks. So when I got out, everybody wanted to be my friend. I loved the thought of being accepted. I had this street credit where everybody loved. I started going out, I started partying, I started using the excuse that, oh, I might have been locked up. Just leave me be, just let me alone. I want to go out and I wanted to let my hair down. Which I was 6 months on and I was still doing it. And my parent, I was getting fed up at the time. Like, and
she had stood by you through all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. To find me to come out and absolutely throw everything back in her face. So the partying kept going. And that's when the drugs started coming heavy. That's what I kept telling people. I'm only enjoying myself. What's the harm? But there was harm. I was harming myself. And my partner was telling me this. And I wasn't listening.
To the point where your family, your partner, who had stood by you while you went to jail for very serious drug offences, actually couldn't live with you outside jail.
So yeah, it got to the point where they couldn't live with me. Nobody wanted me. I had manipulated and lied and stole and done everything. And I got to the point where nobody could be around me. And I found myself homeless then. And I was living in a car. And it was like, man... Another point where I thought, how am I after getting here?
So you've traded a cell, one prison, for a car.
It was a
probably
Peugeot.
About the similar size.
Yeah, a Peugeot 406. I think it was like a 94 Peugeot 406. And I lived in it. I had a couple of jackets that I'd throw over me and sleep in it. At this point, I was still using, I was still doing everything that I taught, but I was doing it all on my own because nobody wanted to be around me. I was isolating myself. And it got really, really, really lonely.
And you were about, what, 28, 29 at this point?
Yeah, 28, 29.
Was that worse than prison, that point where you find yourself alone in a car with your family and friends rejecting you?
It is worse than prison because in prison you have people around you and they won't turn their back on you because, I don't know, it's the way it is, isn't it? But when everybody has turned their back on you for the reason that you can't see, the way they see it is they were... showing me tough love. They needed to keep that distance from me, but I was like the fucking neck of them. You know that way? Like, how dare they? How dare they do this to me? Who needs them and all, you know? But it was very lonely, and I was at that point where I was thinking, I need to do something here. And I remember on my 29th birthday, I was lying there, lonely as hell, about 4 in the morning, knock on the window. Looked up, seeing the reflection of the guard's jacket, and I was like, oh no. I was like, this isn't good. And I get out of the car, and the guard looked at me, and he didn't look through me, he looked at me, and the guard said to me, look, you have to move. And I said, I'd love to, but I can't. And he sort of seen me, he didn't want to ask too many questions, you know, and I said, look, guard, I'm living here, you know, this is all I have. And he said, okay, jump back in, he says, but look after yourself. And got back into the car, put the seat back, threw the jackets off, and I was lying there, and I was like, look after yourself. I was like, why don't you just look after yourself? And like, how do you look after yourself here? What do I have to do? I was like, right, what's my big issue here? Like, big issue is addiction. I can't go without drugs. I need to get addiction sorted. So I knew of Kill Mine. I knew some great stories of Kill Mine.
Which is a drug and alcohol treatment centre.
Yeah, it is, yeah. They've some day programmes, they've treatment centres, residentials, all over Ireland now, it's great. So I made the contact with Kilmoyne, and I remember I got the phone call to say that was a bed for me in Kilmoyne Lodge, which is the men's residential treatment. And walking up to the door of Kilmoyne Lodge, I was shaking. Pure fear of the unknown, fear of everything. What am I doing here? It was actually scarier going into treatment than I was going into prison. Because I knew I'm not going to go in here and I'm not going to be left alone. Like, I'm going to have to start talking about what's going on for me, and I'm going to have to address the issues that's brought me to where I am today. So my whole time through there was the best decision I've ever made. The scariest thing I've ever done. But the outcome was amazing. Like, they've given me everything back. Football would have been a big thing that was taken away from me through addiction. In there, they encouraged me to go for trials for the Homeless World Cup, which I did. Got picked on the team. Went over and represented Ireland in
Mexico
City. Got a
trip to Mexico.
Yeah, like, crazy. You know that way? Like,
from Blanchardstown to Mexico.
From Blanchardstown to Mexico in Sicalo Square, wearing the Ireland jersey with my name on the back of it. The guys in the homeless street leagues are phenomenal. Like, I remember the night before, they had us in a hotel. They had all the Ireland gear laid out in the hotel room for us. They made it really, really good for us, you know. They do great work. But I went from there to being at Sicalo Square representing Ireland, and I just sort of thought to myself, like, right, I can do this, you know, I can really go with this. Like, so from there on, I just sort of said, right, I can do anything. There's nothing really stopping me here. I remember afterwards, I was on the Moira and Dottie show telling me story and that, and like, and I remember this was just something that sort of sticks out. I remember it was quite funny, and I went down to the RT studios in Cork, and the girl called me in. It's like, come on, sit up there. And I was like, what am I doing? She's like, I just want to do your makeup. And I'm like, what? You know that way? I sort of giggled to myself. I'm like, and in my head, I'm thinking, so like, the start of this year, I was homeless, living in a car. Now I'm sitting in an RTE studio. I was waiting to go on a show, getting my makeup
done. I feel
like
I should point out that for listeners who are not familiar with television, all men wear makeup on television. And if they tell you they don't, they're lying.
No, they do. Yeah, they do. I went on like that. I seen it, they do. But it was real, sort of like, this is crazy, you know?
A different world. You got back into exercise, you started doing some charity work, and you got a proper job again.
I was always a victim of my past, and I always thought that my past was going to lead, that was my life forever, but it's not. Once you sort of step out of that little, take the blinkers off, you know, look through the fog, there's more to life than what you really think. Criminality, drugs, there's more to life than all that.
So you're not trapped by the past anymore. You've gone back to college now and you're looking at a new career path. You're studying community drugs and alcohol.
In UCD. It's never something that I thought was going to happen. But I went back working in sales, and my boss at the time was great, you know. I said to him, look, I think I want to career change. I had a little bit of an accident with a car. I got hit by a car and sort of made me look at things differently. And am I really working what I want to do? Like, you should really love your job. Everybody's made to do something, you should do it. So I told him, and he said, yeah, look, go for it. And I told my partner, and she said, yeah, go for it. So I left my job, and I'm now doing a diploma in UCD, and I'm now working in the services for Kilmoyne and Ashley House, helping women, which it's great. I absolutely love it. It doesn't feel like work. And every day I go there, I learn something new about myself. you know, it's amazing, really.
Well, Daniel, I can only wish you well with it, and thanks for sharing your story on the Indo Daily, because it's fascinating, and we don't very often get to hear from people who have spent time in Mountjoy and, even better again, have come out the other side a better person. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thanks very much.
I'm Kevin Doyle, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Mary Carroll, researched by Tabitha Monaghan, recorded by Dara Kelly, with sound design by Graham Davison. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow, or leave us a review.